We're going back to some of the archaeological travels we were digging into. There's God, Graves, and Scholars by C.W. Saram, Story of Archaeology. Many of you will remember, we took you through Botta's discovery of Nineveh. Now, prior to that, Diggs had dug up some cuneiform, but everybody was taking the position. Nobody could transcribe it. When you look at it, you'll understand why. Take a close look. There's the cuneiform script. And when Botta, who began to dig at Nineveh in the mounds around ancient Nineveh, around 1830 to 1840, that significant year, the 1800s of archaeology, people began to recognize that it was the same script. Nobody had cracked it. Nobody had uncovered a way of deciphering it. It was a school teacher named Grotefend. Grotefend, born June 9, 1775 in Germany, at the age of 27, conceived the notion he could find the key to decipher these characters. Some comrades of his bet on his hunch. And on that bet, he tackled it, and he did it. With the cuneiform beginning to be transcribed, I led you some many weeks ago through the experience of Major Henry Rawlinson, who was lowered with the help of block and tackle down the face of a high cliff near Behistun, and found that threefold inscription of Darius the Great. And with the beginnings of cuneiform decipherment done, Rawlinson, taking it further, proclaimed he could decipher even more broadly the cuneiform script, because he had the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone out of Egypt, an inscription in three languages, with one of the languages already deciphered, whereby they could begin to link up an alphabet. Lyard then, building on that, dug up the Tell of Nimrud. He's the one that outsmarted the one-eyed Pasha. Remember that? Well, Lyard continued to dig. In the fall of 1849, Lyard began to work on the mound of Kuyunjik on the banks of the Tigris across from Mosul. He uncovered there one of the greatest palaces of Nineveh. He first drove a vertical shaft into the hill until he struck a stratum of bricks 20 feet down. From this level, he dug horizontal tunnels in various directions and presently hit on a large hall and on a gate flanked by winged bulls, and after 4 weeks' work, he had opened up 9 chambers of the palace of Sennacherib. Remember Sennacherib, who formed the siege on the city of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah? He had opened up 9 chambers of the palace of Sennacherib, one of the mightiest and bloodiest rulers of the Assyrian kingdom. Inscription after inscription was laid bare. Now, as we've traced the lost tribes of Israel, you know that after the initial finds and the more important scripts, tablets, expositions that got the instant attention of scholars around the world were done, some 4,000 shoved aside, that included such things as regular reports from border guards throughout the kingdom of the Assyrian rulers. We suddenly unearth a mountainous amount of reports of those that were guarding the very territories where these 10 tribes of Israel, or to use Baruch's letter as a source, 9.5 tribes of Israel were settled among the borders where the Medes were, between the Tigris River and the Caspian Sea, by these same bloody Assyrian rulers. Inscription after inscription laid bare. We're in the 1800s. Don't expect a theology of the traditional church that didn't know about any of these things until the 1800s to come up with this understanding. Inscription after inscription was laid bare. Nineveh was named after Nin, the great goddess of Mesopotamia. It was a city of vast antiquity. In 1700 B.C., Hammurabi, the Babylonian lawgiver, mentioned the Temple of Ishtar around which the city was built. Yet Nineveh remained a provincial community while Asher and Calah became royal residences. All of this comes up to life from the inscriptions. It was Sennacherib who, in order to avoid Asher, his father's residence, made Nineveh the capital of a land that included all of Babylonia and extended as far as Syria and Palestine to the north, and eastward as far, listen to this, as the wild and chronically rebellious mountain folk. And it was among them that the 10 tribes were settled. Nineveh reached the height of its fame under Ashurbanipal. It was then a city where merchants are more numerous than the stars in the heavens. Now, two books in the Bible deal with Nineveh. Jonah, and Nineveh was spared. Next prophet who speaks lays out the damnation to fall on them. We're now from the archaeological side, seeing its rise to power. It was the political and economic hub of the Mesopotamian region, the culture and artistic center as well, a kind of Assyrian Rome. But during the 7-year reign of Assurbanipal's son, Sennacherib, Kyaxares, king of the Medes, appeared before the walls of Nineveh with an army in force of Persian and Babylonian contingents. He laid siege to the city, took it, razed the walls and palaces, and left nothing behind but a heap of ruins. This happened in 612 B.C., after Nineveh had been the capital of Assyria for only 90 years. Yet how much must have happened during this short interval to make the city a vital memory for 25 centuries. Today we know the truth. Today we know, through the combined efforts of excavator and cryptologist, enough about the lives of Sennacherib and Assurbanipal, and about those who came before and after them, as well, to say that Nineveh was impressed on the consciousness of mankind but little else than murder, plunder, suppression, and the violation of the weak. Now, you can read two books of the Bible that talk about how horrid Nineveh was. Wouldn't the skeptics have loved to have dug up proof that it was a cultural, wonderful, marvelous city that no God of justice, love, goodness, or mercy would wipe out? Now the archaeologists, after Layard's digs, can say today we know the truth. Nineveh was impressed on the consciousness of mankind, though only the capital for 90 years, by little else than murder, plunder, suppression, and the violation of the weak, by war and all manner of physical violence, and by the deeds of a dynasty of rulers who held down the people by terror and who often were liquidated by rivals more ferocious than themselves. That's archaeology's assessment. The good old book, the Bible, keeps bearing out. Sennacherib was the first of the half-mad Caesars. Nineveh was the Assyrian Rome. Mass and ferment. Such a city was Nineveh. Sennacherib reached the limits of his power about the time he attacked Hezekiah, and his army had 185,000 of them killed in one night by God, an angel. The archaeologists say a plague must have hit them. It says here, as a matter of fact, it was a plague that defeated Sennacherib's army, known today as Malaria Tropica. That's a new name for an angel. Malaria Tropica. But at least archaeology confirms there's a heap big bunch of dead men, 185,000 soldiers in one night, on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Whether God used an angel sword or malaria tropica, they were dead. But there's one story, one chapter in the bloody story of Nineveh, and I can go through five pages of it to make you understand why Jonah didn't want to go there and why God laid the condemnation on them, and though they repented briefly in the time of Jonah, didn't take them long to sink back. Archaeology now confirms the evil of that city. This was one chapter in the bloody story that Lollard brought forth with his spade. It's a little different. He was to add to the tale of Nineveh when in Sennacherib's palace he discovered two rooms, apparently added by way of afterthought, which had functioned as a library. Now, the use of the term library to describe these rooms is not at all far-fetched, even from the modern standpoint. For the treasury of information discovered there, now listen, 1,800 years go by. Botta finds Nineveh. Rawlinson, building on Grotefend's interpretation of the cuneiform, uncovers the scripts, and there's no question. We're able now to find out why the tribes were lost. They weren't called Israelites. They sure weren't called Jews. They were called Beth Kumri, House of Kumri, for Umri, second or rather sixth king who put the capital in Samaria of the 10 tribes to the north, sixth king, counting Jeroboam, to the sixth Omri. Rawlinson found in Darius inscriptions they were called Saka, and Rawlinson clearly identifies them as the 10 tribes, being referred to as Saka. In other contexts, be called Saka Sunni, dropping the I, shortening of Isaac's sons, with the name Isaac on them. Lollard then uncovers Nimrud, the palaces of Sennacherib, and 1,800 years have gone by. We're now reading the inscriptions that enable a confirmation of names that can let us trace these scattered tribes. And for the first time, would you imagine this? The use of the term library to describe these rooms is not at all far-fetched, even from the modern standpoint. For the treasury of information discovered there by Lollard comprised nearly 30,000 volumes, a library of clay tablets. Cuneiform has just been broken, and now 30,000 volumes. I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, there's maybe 20 volumes there. Maybe 30 volumes all around me. Multiply that by 1,000. And you'll understand why even now, in the middle of the 1900s or the second half, we are beginning to have fed through the philologists and cryptologists and the sorting the information. And why The ones that didn't immediately attract attention were shoved aside while the more meaty central attention items were translated. Assurbanipal, 688 to 626 B.C., about the time that the 10 tribes in bondage, according to an inscription by Darius, begin to get restless and start their rebellions on the border. About the time the Medes, those rebellious mountainous tribes, start their rebellions on the border. About the time that the 10 tribes alternately would work as mercenaries for one side or the other on occasions. Assurbanipal is the king. He ascended the throne through the influence of his grandmother, Nakia, one-time favorite of Sennacherib. He was the exact temperamental opposite of the tyrant. It wasn't easy to rebel under Sennacherib. We got a bookman now, a library builder, and rebellion starts, and you find another little link that verifies the report of Darius that about 50 years after they're carried into bondage, they rebel. His inscriptions, though as overweening in praise as his predecessors, voice peaceable sentiments and generally reflect Assurbanipal's inclination toward the tranquil life. From this, one must not construe, however, that Assurbanipal did not engage in war. Well, without going on to the description of the king, let me read this. Assurbanipal made a name for himself that will endure through all time by founding his famous library, quote, in order that he might have that which to read, 30,000 volumes worth. The discovery of these tablets was Layard's last great excavational triumph. After this, he handed the torch to others, returned to England, and embarked on his political career. Assurbanipal's library provided a key. Hey, I'm teaching on Genesis, in case you're watching new. These are foundations we're laying for verse by verse through Genesis, as we've been laying foundations for months on Sunday morning and other places for verse by verse through Revelations. Assurbanipal, and I want you to listen, for years the only real attention-getting source of a story of the flood was the Bible. Now, the digs confirm the Bible's judgment of Nineveh. Let's keep going. Assurbanipal's library provided a key to the understanding of the whole Assyrio-Babylonian civilization. The collection had evidently been arranged according to a definite system. The king obtained part of the tablets from private sources, but the largest section consisted of copies he had made of originals scattered throughout all the provinces of his realm. To Babylon, he sent Shadanu, one of his officials, with the following instructions, and this all comes out of the inscriptions. Quote, the day that you receive my letter, take Shuma, his brother, Belater, Ophla, and the artists of Borsippa, whom you know, and collect the tablets, as many as there are in their houses, and as many as there are in the temple of Ezidah. And he ended his orders like this, seek out, bring to me the precious tablets for which there are no transcripts extant in Assyria. I give now written to the temple overseer and to the mayor of Borsippa that you, Shadanu, are to keep the tablets in your storehouse and that nobody shall refuse to hand over tablets to you. And if you hear of any tablet or ritualistic text that is suitable for the palace, seek it out, secure it, and send it here. And a battery went through his empire to form the library. The library, among many things, contained dynastic lists, historical sketches, palace edicts of a political nature, poetical literature consisting of epic, mythical tales, songs, and hymns. And border post reports. Now, Layard's assistant, Hormuzd Rezam, continued to work on Layard's departure. The Psalm was a Chaldean Christian, born in 1826 in Mosul on the Tigris. In 1847, he began his studies at Oxford. 1854, was employed as interpreter at the British Residency in Aden. By the way, notice who leads the way. These British archaeologists are British-trained archaeologists, joined by Germans. And these northern, northwestern European descendants of the Celts are rediscovering their root lands. Not that they were born there, but they were transplanted there and then moved out. I won't tell you all of his story. Just say this. He brought home a bunch of fragments. Among those fragments were a bunch that ultimately comprised the Gilgamesh epic. Now, the full meaning of this work was not properly understood until many years after its discovery. The tracking down of the Gilgamesh epic to the ancient sources was accomplished by a man who died only 4 years after completing the task, and whose commonplace name is most unfairly relegated to marginal comments and footnotes in a majority of archaeological histories. Lawyer dug up the library, Rassam followed it, and there comes to Britain some fragments to the attention of this man. This man was George Smith, another archaeological amateur, and a banknote engraver by profession. He was born on March 26, 1840 at Chelsea in London. Smith was a self-taught man who at night in his little room gave himself over with unparalleled zeal to the study of the first publications in Assyriology. Now I ask you that are here, does it keep coming out, the dedication of these men? At the age of 26, he wrote a few minor commentaries on some cuneiform characters of debated meaning. These essays by the unknown engraver aroused a great deal of professional notice. A couple years later, he was made an assistant in the Egyptian-Assyrian section of the British Museum. In 1872, this erstwhile banknote engraver was sitting over the tablets that Hormuz Rassam had sent to the museum, Lawyer's assistant, who had dug up some more out of the library, trying to decipher these tablets. At this time, no one was aware that there had been an Assyrio-Babylonian literature worthy of being ranked with that of the best of later heroic epics, like those of Homer. As it happened, however, Smith was not interested particularly in the literary quality of the tablets per se. Smith basically was a persevering and apparently a rather amusing man of strict scholarly habits, not at all a poet. He was thrilled by the bare content of the tale, by the what rather than the how of the legend. He wasn't concerned about unearthing the fact that somebody had the ability to write it. The further he progressed with the decipherment, the more excited he became. Bit by bit, Smith unraveled the great deeds of Gilgamesh the Strong. He read about the man of the woods in Kaidu, brought into the city by the priest Hor to subdue Gilgamesh the Modest. But the violent battle of heroes ended in a draw. Gilgamesh and Enkidu became fast friends and, working together, accomplished many noble deeds. They killed Kumbaba, terrible ruler of the cedar forest, and even challenged the gods themselves when they had offended Ishtar, who had offered her love to Gilgamesh. Now you're getting a clue. Who's the hero? Nimrod. Who's Gilgamesh? Nimrod. Who's Ishtar? Semiramis. The Babylonian wife of Nimrod. Nimrod, founder of the first cities of the plains. Is Josephus. He had access, the famous Jewish historian about the first century. Almost a writing contemporary. Of Jesus. He offers a complaint in the fifth chapter of his Antiquities. Josephus' Antiquities starts with the first chapter, the constitution of the world and the disposition of the elements. The famous Jewish historian who should be rated with Herodotus of the Greeks, Tacitus of the Romans. Second chapter concerning the posterity of Adam and the 10 generations from him, that is Adam, to the deluge. Chapter 3, concerning the flood and after what manner Noah was saved in an ark with his kindred and afterwards dwelt in the plain of Shinar. Chapter 5, after what manner the posterity of Noah sent out colonies and inhabited the whole earth. And he begins to talk about the Greeks, who became the authors of mutations in history. By mutations, he's not talking about biological. When in the after ages, they grew strong, they claimed to themselves the glory of antiquity. Here is Josephus saying, in a day much earlier than modern history professors, you know, the Greeks have been getting so much credit. They're fakers and cheaters. That's what he's saying. Now, until the mid-1800s, the Greco-Roman dominance of the world, the product of German historians and philosophers as a view of history, dominated the world. Because Darwin's evolutionary theory had spread to social evolution, and the laws of evolution said you start out a savage and you grow, evolve toward civilization. So you don't dare have somebody centuries late dumber than those who were centuries early. Or the whole system crumbles. I mean, you don't dare find a limestone strata that has an evolved fossil more advanced at an earlier age than a later fossil, less advanced. And since Darwin had worked it out that everything is evolving and the social evolutionists, with the Germans taking the lead, had bought it, then the culture they knew, with archaeology not yet really taking shape as a science, the culture they knew, Greco-Roman, had to be the most superior culture of the world. Well, old Josephus says, they're a bunch of mutators. For when in the after ages they grew strong, potent is his word, not having been strong before, but really kind of peanuts, they claimed to themselves the glory of antiquity. Now what he's saying is we Jews were before you were. And what he's going to point out, along with some other people, is with some of their descendants, that founded their cities and ruled them in greatness. And the Spartans were of Abraham, not climbing out of the sea somewhere on a rock in Greece long before Abraham ever left earth. That's the point he's making. They cheated. They grew strong. They claimed to themselves the glory of an antiquity they didn't have, giving names to the nations that sounded good in Greek, that they might better understand among themselves, or that the names might be better understood among themselves, and setting agreeable forms of government over them as if they were a people derived from themselves. You know what they did? They took ancient people that didn't come from the Greeks at all, and they put Greek names on them and stamped on them Greek interpretations of their culture and their governments so that they could make them look like their predecessors. Ooh. Boy, does that do a number on the Greeks. Now, he tells us concerning the flood, the place of descent, and the attitude of the people who were fearful. Listen, Mount Ararat was not where it landed in Turkey. It'd take a deep sea diver to find the top of that mountain from where the ark was setting the first time it settled down. And Josephus tells of the fears that these people had. God commanded them to send colonies forth. Now the sons of Noah were three, Shem, Japheth, and Ham. These first of all descended from the mountains into the plains and fixed their habitation there, and persuaded others who were greatly afraid of the lower grounds on account of the flood, and so were very loath to come down from the higher places to venture to follow their examples. Isn't that interesting? And just listen for a minute. Now the sons of Noah were three, Shem, Japheth, and Ham, all born 100 years before the flood. These, Shem, Japheth, and Ham. Now, who's that leave? Noah and his wife, and their three wives. These eight souls. These, first of all, descended from the mountains into the plains and fixed their habitation there, and persuaded others who were greatly afraid of the lower grounds on account of the flood, and so were very loath to come down from the high places to venture to follow their examples. Who were these others? What did they do? Leave Daddy Noah and his wife and their three wives? Were they the others? Who were these others? I'll skip a ways. Now, it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt to God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man, and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God as if it was through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was through their own courage that they procured their happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God but to bring them into constant dependence on his power. He also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. Now the multitude were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod, and to esteem it a piece of cowardice to submit to God. And let's leave that there. Now that's the record of the deluge and the biblical record. Now, the Bible just simply says, can I go on? See who old Nimrod is over in the Bible. We've read him before, but let's get them all side by side. Of Cush begat Nimrod, he began to be a mighty one. His name means rebel. In the earth, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The word before equally translates against. The context suggests Nimrod, the mighty hunter, against the Lord. At the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Now the archaeologists and the philologists have dug up the Sumerians and the Akkadians. Nimrod began these kingdoms. Out of that land went forth Asshur and builded Nineveh and the city of Rehoboth and Calah. And reason between Nineveh and Calah the same as a great city. Now we know Nimrod, the whole earth was of one language, and it came to pass they journeyed from the east. As they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Now, I want to tell you something. Walk down on a map, Mount Ararat in Turkey, and go east, and fall off into the Aegean Sea. You don't even come close to Shinar. And yet there are people still trying to dig up the ark on Mount Ararat. I tell you, it'd take a deep-sea diver to find the top of the mountain. The ark settled in those highlands near Tibet long before the waters ever settled down enough to reveal Mount Ararat in Turkey. Just because Ararat's got the name today doesn't mean that's what it was when the ark settled in. I'll take you to that axis of the world. We can ever keep the budget going, solve some other things, and get there. They said one to another, let me say this. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. You come out of the highlands across the mountains from Iran into the plain of Shinar. You don't leave Ararat and head across Turkey to Shinar. They came from the east, and they dwelt there, and they said one to another, go, let us make brick and burn it. Let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make a name lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. That's the Bible record. Who were those other people that were scared to come down from the high places? Huh? You say that's not Bible. I know it, but still, I'm curious. What made him say that? Bit by bit, I'm back here now. Bit by bit, Smith unraveled the great deeds of Gilgamesh, the strong. Nimrod built that city. The Bible told us that, right? I can take you to the next chapter in the Bible in the genealogies, and you will find out. Nimrod died when Abram was 9 years old. Semiramis, his wife, whose name becomes Ishtar and Ashtoreth, as it moves into the Canaanite territories, continued to rule about another 50 years. Abram's boyhood in Ur in Babylon, under the influence of the old Akkadian and Sumerian cultures founded by Nimrod, Abram grew up. Hey, I'm 52. I feel like I've lived forever. By analogy, all my life, the first 9 years, Nimrod would have been the king, and all the rest of my life, until about 4 or 5 years ago, Semiramis would have been ruling with her practices dominating my city. Noah is still alive. Well into the early days of these rebellions. Shem lives through them and long afterward. And Ham's down in Egypt, embanking the river and driving the sea back until his name changes and matches the name, Menes, of the king that founds Egypt by embanking the river and keeping it from being a swamp in all of the lowlands. And the name of his work becomes the name in ancient Bible of the city itself, I mean of the country itself, Egypt, Mizraim. Where was Noah? My Lord, he lived so long after the flood, hundreds of years. How come he didn't have any more kids? Wait a minute. Some people over there are saying he did. Do you know that or are you guessing? Guessing? There is no record anywhere in history that he ever had another kid. Ethel over here says three was enough. Depends on whether you look at Shem or Ham. You could use 30 like Shem. Doesn't it puzzle you that he never had any more kids? All kinds of mysteries in this book. Let me go back to this. Nimrod is ruling. Semiramis, who becomes Ishtar, Ashtoreth, Diana of the Ephesians, Aphrodite of the Greeks. The Gilgamesh epic mentions her. Gilgamesh and Enkidu became fast friends and working together accomplished many noble deeds. Remember, this epic is told from the Babylonian side. They killed Kumbaba, terrible ruler of the cedar forest, and even challenged the gods themselves when they had offended Ishtar, who had offered her love to Gilgamesh. Laboriously translating, Smith read farther along how Enkidu died of a frightful sickness, how he was mourned by Gilgamesh, who, to avoid a similar fate, set out to find immortality. During his wanderings, he meets up with Utnapishtim, the primeval ancestor of mankind. This Utnapishtim and his family, when the gods visited the great punishment on the wicked human race, you know we're in the middle 1800s now? This comes out of that library. Nobody had ever seen this. This Utnapishtim and his family, when the gods visited a great punishment on the wicked human race, had been the only survivors of the debacle. Afterwards, the gods had made them immortal. The practice early now of taking historic figures who have a basis for being respected and elevating them to divine status. That didn't start with the Greeks. That didn't start with the Irish who elevated the Tuatha De Danann to divine status. They start as historic people. Utnapishtim then tells Gilgamesh the whole story of his miraculous escape. Smith read this with eager eyes. As his initial excitement began to evolve into certainty of a remarkable discovery, bigger and bigger gaps appeared in the narrative flow of the Rassam tablets. Smith had to reconcile himself to the fact that he had only pieces, fragments of the total inscription to work with. Indeed, and I was here once before, indeed the most essential section of the story was entirely missing. The conclusion. What Smith had read of the Gilgamesh epic left him no rest. He couldn't keep silent, though to disclose them was sure to rock the Bible-bound England of Victoria's day. Later, a powerful newspaper came to George Smith's aid. The London Daily Telegraph announced that it was offering the sum of 1,000 guineas to anyone who would go to Kyunjik and find the missing Gilgamesh inscriptions and bring them back to England. George Smith, the former banknote engraver, with the story unfinished for him, accepted the offer. He traveled the thousands of miles separating London from Mesopotamia, and there boldly attacked the tremendous pile of rubble that was Kyunjik. The mound and respective total area had hardly been scratched. He began the search for the missing tablets. His task was about comparable to finding one particular water louse in the sea, or the famous needle in the haystack. Now, I've read this to you before, but we're ready for it now. How many times have we seen accidents that are miraculous in this archaeological search in the 1800s? Again, there occurred one of the most unbelievable wonders that stud the history of archaeological excavation. Smith actually found the missing parts. 30,000 volumes in the library, scattered fragments in associated mounds. He brought home altogether 384 fragmentary clay tablets. Among them, the missing parts of the controversial story of Utnapishtim. This tale was a variation of the biblical legend of the flood. Now, there are, of course, flood stories in almost every folklore. But this one was concerned with the very same deluge described in Genesis. Coming from the same area, from the descendants of the cursed line, rather than the descendants of the blessed line, Shem. Nimrod and Babel. You're not going to have God's protection on the oracle report. You're going to have a corruption, but still a report of the same events from the other side. And I've told you over and over again, we'll get to it. The writer of Worlds and Collision, the book that made him famous, had already started Ages and Chaos, where from the Egyptian records that archaeology had uncovered, he reconstructs the Egyptian side, what their records had to say of the events surrounding the exodus out of Egypt. Now, here we have the same thing about the flood. Utnapishtim, indeed, was none other than Noah. How's that for a little different spelling on a word? Noah, from their view, becomes Utnapishtim. The friendly god Ea versus El. The friendly god Ea, in a dream, had revealed the god's punitive intent to Utnapishtim, Ea's protege, whereupon Utnapishtim decided to build himself an ark. Then comes the story. Impossible to question the fact that the primal version of the biblical legend of the deluge had been found. Specific events are duplicated. As, for instance, the freeing of the dove and the raven. The text in cuneiform raised for Smith's generation the disturbing question, was the Bible no longer the oldest historical source we had? No question. No question that this legend goes back to a source and a telling earlier than the birth of Moses, who wrote down the biblical record. But Moses had sources equally ancient and more accurate. guided by God, schooled in all the wisdom of Egypt. Look, Egypt had both Ham and Shem to lay down its roots. Smith's generation was disturbed. Our generation no longer fears it. Archaeology has continued to confirm, not destroy. Now, the legend of Gilgamesh was now complete. I'll leave it there. I have another book here. Alexander Heidel, The Gilgamesh Epic and Old Testament Parallels. It takes it like, see if I can get it proper on the light so you can see it. Cuneiform records made some 3,000 years ago are the basis for this essay on the ideas of death and the afterlife and the story of the flood, which were current among the ancient peoples of the Tigro-Euphrates Valley. And like a parallel harmony of the Gospels, he takes the Gilgamesh Epic and the Old Testament parallels. Now, I'll have fun with this, if we can ever get to it. Nimrod, seeking the answer to immortality, shattered by the death of a friend, finds Noah. When you read in the epic the long journey that he took to find Noah, you know that Noah is not settled in the Babylonian valley. You know that Noah is not living in Mesopotamia. Where was this ancient sage Noah living, which required the long journey of Gilgamesh to reach? And what was the nature of that reach? And was it all on land, or did he have to get in a boat? Wouldn't you like to know? We'll get to it. This is interesting. Like the Odyssey and other great epics, the Gilgamesh epic opens with a brief resume of the deeds and fortunes of the hero whose praises it sings, Gilgamesh. To reach the dwelling place of Utnapishtim, Gilgamesh must go on a long and arduous journey fraught with many dangers. He arrives at the towering mountain range of Mashu, probably the Lebanon or anti-Lebanon range. Here is the gate through which the sun passes on his daily journey. The gate is guarded by a terrible, terrifying pair of scorpion people whose look is death and whose frightful splendor overwhelms mountains. The sight of them, even Gilgamesh becomes gloomy with fear. But these terrible people, recognizing the partly divine nature of Gilgamesh, receive him kindly and permit him to enter the gate and traverse the mountain range. After a journey of 12 double hours of utter darkness, he comes out on the other side and stands before a beautiful garden of precious stones with trees and shrubs and fruits and vines, all of glittering stone. Now, we're not very far from the flood, remember that. And there in the distance, at the edge of the sea, dwells Siduri, the divine barmaid. Remember, this is a Babylonian side of the story. Gilgamesh hastens thither and inquires of her how he can get to Utnapishtim to obtain from him the secret of immortality. Now, as they mocked the Odyssey and the Iliad and the epic hero stories of Homer and Schliemann proved, they had a basis in fact. Don't expect the non-divinely protected epics to not exaggerate. It's as we have found in the bards and the responsibilities for those poets of Ireland. They can take license with details, but the solid facts remain unchanged. The foundation facts. We're not dealing with divine oracle protection, which keeps the biblical record the acme of accuracy, standing the test of time. We're dealing with the non-divine supervised record of basic facts embellished by the oft-telling thereof among heathen. Got that? But the fact that there was a Gilgamesh who made a journey, that's basic. That he left Mesopotamia seeking the primeval father of all the race. Who was that? Noah. He's the father of the race that's left alive, whose family in this story survived the flood. And out of the time of Nimrod, he has to go looking for him a long distance across Palestine to the west till he comes to a sea. Well, which sea do you think that is? Probably the Mediterranean, off or on the Phoenician coast. Now, skip over the barmaid. I mean, by the time they told this 1,000 times without God's supervision in ancient Babylon, nobody could make a trip without a barmaid meeting them somewhere. The barmaid at first tries to persuade him that his quest is vain. He continues to inquire, how can he get to Utnapishtim to obtain from him the secret of immortality? She tells him there's no escape from death. She therefore advises him to enjoy life in full measure and to abandon his hazardous yet hopeless undertaking. Now, what barmaid wouldn't give that kind of advice? I mean, here's a good-looking, sensitive man looking for immortality, and he meets the barmaid. She says, let's have fun. That's what all that translates into. Nevertheless, Gilgamesh persists in his plan. He's the kind of man who always frustrates barmaids. At last, the barmaid directs him to Utnapishtim's boatman. Ooh. Now we've got to get on a boat to find Noah, who has come across from the other side of the sea, where Utnapishtim dwells. Him let thy face behold, she tells Gilgamesh, if it is possible, cross over with him. If not possible, turn back home. Gilgamesh leaves the goddess, she's called now. I mean, all you got to do is leave on a risky journey, and the barmaid companion looks like a goddess when you're leaving. And goes to the boatman. Well, a barmaid would look like a goddess alongside a boatman, who at length agrees to take him along. With much difficulty, the two cross the sea and the waters of death and finally arrive at the shores of the land of blessed Utnapishtim. When Gilgamesh sees Utnapishtim and notices what? People haven't watched me a while get frustrated. People who watch me for a long time stay frustrated. You want me to take one of these things and finish it. And you don't believe me when I tell you that I subscribe to a theory of learning, field theory or gestalt theory, that wants to force you out of a myopic, piece-by-piece exhaustion of a specialized area to an insight that will land on you like a ton of bricks somewhere along the journey. God's Word is what we're concerned in. God's not a man to lie is what we're involved in demonstrating. And all these various books from every frame come at it from their specialty. And unless you've got the gestalt of the whole book of God, you won't really see. All they keep doing is just filling in the gaps and proving up God. Now, everybody is giving me books all the time, and I just jump up and down with joy when nobody's looking. Because they all converge in a stream of truth that says the same thing. Beginning in the 1800s, the whole viewpoint of history and archaeology had to rearrange itself. And the good old book, the Bible, is coming through another outburst of knowledge stronger than it ever was. Now, the Gilgamesh epic doesn't do anything to hurt God's Word. Makes you thank God for the divine protection that didn't embellish and told the record that God wanted told in a way that you don't ever have to be embarrassed that any part of it won't be borne out as more knowledge is uncovered. These other streams of epic truth have their factual foundations, but embellish out of sight. You'll find that same characteristic when we concentrate on the history of the Irish race out of their old chronicles and legends. But the basic substructure can be followed from many sources. Now, if you get frustrated at me jumping around, just stay around a while. You'll stay frustrated, as I've said, but believe it or not, I'll go back and go through the promises of God, which I do intend to take, detailed and step by step, as we've demonstrated a few times. But the broad feel, which is what I'm after, feel of the supporting structure of surrounding history will be there. You don't have to remember the facts, the feel. You don't have to really remember, thousands of you that have watched, all the facts that led you to a conclusion that lots of you didn't have many months ago. The tribes can be found and never have been lost. You don't have to remember the details to know that those mysterious appearing nomads called Scythians and Sumerians north of the Black Sea, appearing at the same time the tribes disappeared south of the Black Sea, linked by Second Esdras with the trip through the mountains, are reappearing under a different name, but are the same people that were carried into bondage in Assyria. You got a feel for that now. And every little piece of evidence just strengthens the feel. Now, let me jump around. I figure if they can do it on... Have you ever figured out in an ordinary soapbox or soap opera in that box called a TV? How many things people remember? I saw an ad the other day on Dallas. Whole bunch of faces and names saying last Friday night some momentous event would change all their lives and one of them would topple. I said, you ain't going to get me to look. Don't anybody dare tell me who toppled. I don't want to know. But thousands of people are tracing these little stupid lives on a half a dozen soap operas. They know every affair and every operation in General Hospital for the last 10 years. Well, I figure that this is a lot more interesting. And I got to make these various things come into the intersection from all their various streams at the same time. And if I stay with one from A to Z, you won't know what's happening in the other places while I'm at A here, and when I get to Z, by the time I go back to A, the twain will never meet. I want you to get a feel for what was happening in the years immediately following the flood, in the years when Abram pulled out of Ur, in the years when his descendants went down into Egypt, immediately preceding their coming out of Egypt to form what the Bible clearly records, the tribes and the land of Palestine and the split of the kingdoms. Because those 10 tribes scattered have got to confront some descendants of their Hebrew forefathers in some other places. That's why I'm doing all of this. And you got to get a feel for it. Now, let me show you something. In the Bible, I'm changing the subject. Those other things that are dangling, let them dangle. I'm changing the subject. You got that? I'm going to repeat again. You just hang on. I review often enough. You won't be lost very long. If you've been lost all the time you've ever listened to me, you're on the wrong channel. It won't change. But if you've been found a moment or two, stick around. It'll all come together. Go to Genesis. The predecessors of the tribes who split up. Now you think, everybody thinks those tribes came out of Egypt? Just a bunch of slaves down there in Egypt, dumb bunnies, making bricks without straw and having kids and hiding them. That's their life story. Slaves making bricks without straw and hiding their kids. And Moses lucked out. He got found. I was going to pull out, but I buried it. Josephus records here and tells in great detail the final end of the Ethiopian wars, one of the descendants of Ham, who continued to fight against other descendants of Ham in Egypt. And it was none other than Moses, great general, great statesman trained in all the wisdom of Egypt, who finally put an end to the Ethiopian wars. He knew all about Egypt. And he was descended from people before they became slaves, who were not smelly, scroungy shepherds wearing overgrown kilts and nothing underneath them from the neck to the ankles, living in about 70 tents maximum, riding on a mangy ass, begging for food. The Hebrews were not born after Moses let them out. Ezekiel 23, we've gone to it many times. Don't go there. I'm not going to stay very long. The word of the Lord came again unto me, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother. And they committed whoredoms in Egypt. The names of them were Aholah the elder and Aholibah her sister. And they were mine, and they bare sons and daughters. Thus were their names. Samaria is Aholah, and Jerusalem Aholibah. Now by Ezekiel's day, the whole kingdom of the 10 tribes to the north was called Samaria. The kingdom to the south, Judah, occasionally called Jerusalem, the whole being named for the capital. When the Assyrians conquered the 10 tribes, it was called Samaria because the sixth king, Umri, had put the capital at Samaria. So the people were called by the Assyrians Beth Umri, and they did it with a harsh aspirate sound, Beth Krumri. And the name eventually becomes Kimri or Simri or the Sumerians. Well, now, Samaria wasn't formed until the sixth king named it Samaria. And the ten-tribe kingdom of Ephraim in Israel was not formed until Jeroboam received the kingdom during the days of the son of Solomon. Yet years earlier, through the prophet now, God is looking back and calling Samaria and Judah or Jerusalem by a name that he gave them when they were in Egypt. This is long before they ever split. They were seen in God's eyes as two from the day that those tribes came from Leah and Rachel. An enmity was between them. Aholah and Aholibah. They learned. It's graphic language. She doted on her lovers. She committed her whoredoms with them. Neither left she her whoredoms brought from Egypt. They didn't learn how to worship the calf. Somebody wrote a note earlier after communion and said, those guys on that hill that saw God still built the bull later. Not only that, Nadab and Abihu brought the strange fire into the worship of God and were later slain by him. They had learned their evil ways in Egypt. They were not 400 years dirty, beat down, smelly shepherds turned slaves hiding their kids in a basket. Now let's go back to Genesis and I'll show you again. We've already covered it once. Joseph, the psalm says, was sent by God to Egypt. And became the ruler in Egypt. He wasn't any small-time ruler. He is the whole cheese. I got to find that passage first, where he's lifted to power out of prison and becomes the ruler of all Egypt. Genesis 41. You probably got it marked. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, after Joseph interpreted his dream and this old story that everybody that goes to Sunday school knows. Hang on, men. I'll be back in a minute. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, for as much as God hath showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I've set thee over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand, put it upon Joseph's hand, arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck, made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, bow the knee. And he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I'm Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Nobody is to lift a hand or a foot without Joseph's permission. Does that mean he's the boss? We've covered this before. Joseph was 30 years old when that happened. He went out from the presence of Pharaoh, went throughout how much of the land of Egypt? All of it. He gathered up all the food of the 7 years of plenty. Took all the food. Now let's watch him. Hang on a minute. Go to the 47th chapter of Genesis. He gathered up all the food during the years of plenty. 14th verse, Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt. All of it. Do you know anybody in the world today with the power to get all your money? Even the IRS hasn't got that power yet. Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt. Got that? Then with all the money, when money failed in the land of Egypt, I guess so, Joseph had it all. All the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread. Joseph said, give your cattle and I'll give you for your cattle. So now to get bread, they give him cattle. They brought their cattle to Joseph. When he had all the cattle and all the money and all the flocks and all the herds, 20th verse says he bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. He owned it all. The Zinzendorf of ancient history. He bought all the land. Now he had all the money, all the food, all the animals. As for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other. He just moved them around like checkers. Hey, you go over here. Then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I bought you this day. Who's the slaves? Huh? Come on, talk to me. Who's the slaves? Then he put them to work after he moved them around like checkers and said, 20% of everything you raise, you're going to have to give to the king. Talk about 10% tithe. You say, I'm poor. He just moved them around like sharecroppers. He said, you keep four parts, give fifth part, 20% to Pharaoh. They said, thou hast saved our lives. We'll be Pharaoh's servants. That's more than some Christians will do. They won't give God 10%. He saved your life eternally. Joseph made a law over the land of Egypt unto this day. The Pharaoh should have the fifth part. Now, while he was in power, his brothers come down. You know all the story of everything else about him coming down. But after Joseph revealed himself to him, and Jacob came down with his family, Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? They said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. Now, I've been over this before, but I have a reason for reviewing it today. We be shepherds. You got that? Now, it is a saying today, clear to the modern day. Historically, through the history of Egypt, they hated shepherds. They didn't hate him yet. We be shepherds. Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. I heard another Christian station had interviewed Begin in Israel. And they did a trick that I've seen a lot of people tell you off, they pray. Father, we pray that you give the fellow good sense so he'll not tell him he ought to do and he won't talk back to me and the next he'd be done. I used that for me. I was in there as a consultant. And when I didn't go the right way on some things, he'd pray. He said, let's pray. And he'd grab my hands and then he'd tell me off. Finally, one day I looked at him and said, Oral, just look at me and tell me what you want. I mean, don't lay it on to God. This Christian was doing begging. I'm told this happened. Begging, being the courteous man he is, said yes. And they prayed, God, among other things, help the government of Israel to see it's in thy will to station in Jerusalem. And when they got done with the pit, they said, that'll never happen. God gets blamed for a lot of things he should not be blamed for. But the reason I'm telling that story now, you better be Mr. High on the Corn if you're going to bless a ruler. Paul in the New Testament proves that Melchizedek was greater than Aaron, because Aaron was in Abram's loins, he says, when Abram paid tithe to Melchizedek and received Melchizedek's blessing. You don't bless somebody unless you're over them. Oh, you know, modern Christianity blesses everybody. Bless you. But in the Bible, only the higher blesses the lower. You understand that? You read the book of Esther, to go in the presence of one of those ancient kings that had the power of life and death, to just utter it. Even his wife had to be fearful if she went in his presence without an invitation. You think this is a scabby, smelly shepherd? Poor as a decayed hound's tooth? Looking at the king of all Egypt saying, get out now, I'm going to bless you. Lay hands on you and bless you. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, you mangy dog, who are you blessing? No, that isn't what he said. That's what he would have said if Jacob was like most people try to portray it, a poor old mangy shepherd, a handout coming down. Because of Joseph, he can tremblingly come into Pharaoh's camp. Jacob blessed him. Pharaoh apparently liked it. Pharaoh said unto Jacob, how old art thou? Jacob said, days of the years of my pilgrimage, 130 years. Few and evil of the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage. He puts himself down in relationship to his fathers. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh a second time. And it looks to me like he didn't wait to be dismissed by Pharaoh. He blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. Can you put flesh and blood in this and understand what it was like to come in the presence of the mightiest monarch of the world, as history would describe it, and think a shepherd with lice in his hair is going to bless him? When the Egyptians, among other things, were noted for their cleanliness in those days, and a few changes of late. Jacob blessed him twice. You got the point? The very exchange between Pharaoh and Jacob was a recognition that Jacob was a king of greater reputation than Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee, speaking to Joseph, says, the land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell, and if thou knowest any man of activity among them, make them rulers over my cattle. Now listen, we be shepherds. The old patriarch Jacob blesses him. Joseph owns all the money, all the livestock, all the land, and all the people. Now Pharaoh says to Joseph, take your brethren, your father, pick the best of the land, whatever's the best in Egypt, Goshen, give it to them. And anybody among them that has ability, make them the rulers over my cattle. Chief shepherds. Who's the boss? Who's slave? Let's go a little further. Old Jacob dies. And we've been over this, but I want you to see it because I'm going to add a little further step. They're in Egypt. And Jacob begins to bless them in the 48th chapter. He tells Ephraim, multitudes of nations will come out of him. He tells Manasseh, multitudes will come out of him. 49th chapter, he gathers his sons together and begins to bless them. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Where do you find any of these wondrous blessings of power and strength? One of the kids said, hey, Dad, we're just poor slaves making bricks with no straw and hiding our kids when they're born. I mean, did you get drunk before you started blessing us, or are you going on a senile trip? I mean, what's this business of blessing us in bondage like this? They weren't in bondage. We're in bondage. When he finished blessing, he died in the 49th chapter. And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physician, to embalm his father, and the physicians embalmed Israel. And 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which are the embalmed. You didn't embalm poor, scraggly shepherds with a handout. You embalm the rulers. Forty days were fulfilled for him. For so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. 50th chapter. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Who mourned for him for 70 days? A mangy shepherd slave? A king. When the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, lo, I die. Now listen, Jacob's not the king of Egypt. His sons are not kings in Egypt. Joseph is the ruler of all Egypt, and there's another Pharaoh. But Jacob is recognized as a king of sufficient repute. He can literally bless Pharaoh without producing resentment. They're given the best of the land, and their men with leadership ability are made rulers over the Pharaoh's cattle. Now Jacob does. The recognition of power that these people have, though not yet rulers, Joseph is the ruler. Pharaoh is behind him. The Egyptians mourn him. That's his repute. And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake to the house of Pharaoh, saying, my dad made me swear he could be buried in Canaan. So let me go bury him. Pharaoh said, go up and bury thy father. Do what he made thee swear. Still respecting this fellow king, Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went, again, you read this with me, so underline it again. How many of the servants of Pharaoh? All the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders or rulers of the land of Egypt. And all the house of Joseph. And his brother and his father's house, Only their little ones and their flocks and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. If they were in enemy territory, you think they'd have left their kids? And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. They came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with great and very sore lamentation 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians." Wherefore the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. The meaning of that name is the mourning of Egypt. The Canaanites saw it as a funeral party of Egyptians. The greatest funeral possession ever to go into that land. And they go back. Joseph is still the ruler. He lives many years. He dies. And the kingdom of Egypt goes on, being ruled by somebody. Then the book of Exodus opens and it says, "There rose up a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph." Now you go to other records and you find the Hyksos. Archaeologists say misnamed by the Grecians. Foreigners. Foreign kings is the way it should be translated from the Egyptian inscriptions, is what the archaeologists say. The Greeks, describing them, call them Hyksos, shepherd kings. When did the shepherd kings rule Egypt? Well, let's see. Somebody gave me a history's timeline. It was laying here today when it came. So I said, you know, let's just look at this and see what's going to happen. I'll write in a few things. And it's got timelines of great happenings in history. Come on in close. In all cultures. A nice little book. It just records timelines of happenings from every culture in consecutive order. Now I'll read these. 1925 B.C., 1960 B.C., 1830 B.C., 1790 B.C. Now here at 1830 B.C., first dynasty of Babylonian kings founded. And we come to 70. Well, I can't read upside down. 1760. Go back to it. 1760 something. 1730, the Hyksos, Semitic. You know what Semitic comes from? Descendants of Shem. Because they couldn't say Shibboleth in some places. They couldn't pronounce CH or SH. So they dropped the H sound. Semitic is Shemitic. Descendants of Shem, of whom the Hebrew race come. The Hyksos-Semitic tribe begins conquest of Egypt, founds beginning of the Semitic tribe founding the 15th dynasty. Now, 2 years later, Hammurabi comes to power in Babylon. Now, isn't that an interesting date? Just let me think about it for a second. Write it down in your Bible. 1730 B.C., the Hyksos, a Semitic tribe, began conquest of Egypt, founding the 15th dynasty. I pulled out my chronological Bible now. And check it. And a few dates in it. Exactly when did Jacob go down to Egypt, I said to myself. You writing these down? 1843 B.C. is when the old man went down to Egypt And the king said, "Who are you guys?" "Shepherds," they said. "I'm getting space to write. But since I'm going to make them erase all of this, let me write it. Just write over it." 1843 B.C., Jacob to Egypt. Got that? 1843 B.C., Jacob to Egypt. Jacob dies. 1826 B.C., he dies. Now, Joseph is still ruling. 1772 B.C., Joseph dies. Now, Joseph is ruling, and we know there's another Pharaoh, because that's the one that elevated Joseph, right? A Pharaoh of, assumably, Egyptian heritage. When is Moses born? Moses is born 1527 B.C. And we know that when Moses is born, they are slaves. Boy, you got to watch this if you're going to figure it out. You got to see me ride it on. If you don't see me when I ride it on, you're in trouble, friend. Here's the timeline. Let's put red wavy lines through it. We know that Moses was born a slave. So sometime before Moses was born, they are slaves. But they're sure not slaves when Joseph is ruling. Got that? Somewhere between the death of Jacob, when the great funeral procession went to Egypt, and the birth of Moses, we got them falling into slavery. We don't know exactly where, but somewhere between 1826 and 1527, a period of 300 years, they fall into slavery. Got that? Now, they were in Egypt four generations by one calculation. They weren't slaves the whole time. Somewhere between the death of Jacob, possibly after the death of Joseph, nay, probably, they become slaves. Because Joseph is dead, a Pharaoh rises who knows not Joseph and makes him slaves. So we know now certainly it's after 1826 that they become slaves, right? After the death of Joseph, they become slaves. And somewhere, no, Joseph died 1772. Move it down a little further. Somewhere after 1772, they become slaves. Somewhere after 1772 and before 1527. Right? Got that? Now, what happens in this time span that's biblical, that's outside of Bible? We just read it. Where is the blasted book? Thank you. My mother said, "You dropped it under your feet." Now, isn't this interesting? I wish I had a yellow marker now to write on. Isn't this interesting? This Independent History's timeline. Who published this? Gene Crook, Ann Kramer, Theodore Roland Entwistle. My Lord, what a name. Crescent Books, New York. Well, I'll be switched. I don't know who they are. Isn't it interesting that the Hyksos, in, what did we say? Somewhere after Joseph dies. Huh? 1730 these people have the Hyksos taking over, founding, and 1570, the Hyksos are driven out. Moses is born in 1527. 1570 would be how many years? 43 years, isn't it? 43 years before the birth of Moses, the Hyksos, shepherd kings, are driven out. They become foreign rulers in 1730, and in 1570, almost 200 years later, they're driven out. Now let's just speculate for a moment. All history says these foreign rulers conquered Egypt. Doesn't tell us how. Has no record of the battle. Doesn't give us any facts. They just assume. You can't take over a kingdom like Egypt without conquering it. So they can't find a battle, but they say they conquered them. Now, Joseph is ruling until 1772 B.C. 1730, some foreign shepherd kings take the throne of Egypt. Forty-two years after Joseph dies. Now, Joseph was younger than the Pharaoh that appointed him. Joseph is all power in Egypt. He's placed his family in the richest land. He's placed his brethren in rulership positions. Now, what makes you think that there isn't a power vacuum when Joseph dies? And Joseph's been long dead when a Pharaoh rises up who knew not Joseph. Well, who's the Pharaoh that doesn't know Joseph? He's the one that drove out the shepherd kings. So who are these shepherd kings? A power vacuum when Joseph dies, his brethren ruling all over Egypt, one of them. The only explanation. They didn't have to conquer Egypt. It was theirs for the taking. In the power vacuum when Joseph died. Now, since Jacob had already blessed them, if one of them is going to be chosen to rule during the shepherd king domain, since Jacob had said the scepter will not depart from Judah, whom will they choose to rule as a shepherd king? A descendant of Judah. Now, at the same time, in date, at the same time and date that the shepherd kings are thrown off, Dardanus, a son of Zara, a ruler descendant of Judah, leaves Egypt by ships and founds Troy. Now, you don't really think that these shepherd king descendants of the power of Judah and the king of Canaan, Jacob, a ruler in Egypt, would just suddenly decide, okay, you guys have had it long enough, change places now. Everybody change now. We've been the slaves, you be the slaves. It's your turn. Now every little descendant of Jacob says, fair enough. We've had it 200 years. We'll be the slaves. There was an uprising. And the shepherd kings were ejected. And the rest of Israel left in bondage. And that's why at about exactly 1500, give or take 50 years, about 1500 B.C., enough years for these ejected rulers of Egypt to take off in various directions, you find a host of city kingdoms beginning to develop. Troy, Sparta. That's why a modern philologist will write a book on the common heritage in language of the Hebrews and the Greeks. Got a good cameraman. He saw me looking for a handkerchief and he just turned the camera to find it. All I had to do was catch the camera out of the corner of my eye and I knew where my handkerchief was. You see where I'm going? We've got to find the roots of the descendants of Zarah and Judah who spewed out of Egypt, forming kingdoms whose descendants would fulfill the promise of God of the lineage of Judah, so that there was more to the lineage of Judah than the Zedekiah branch and the Jehoiakim branch during the time of Nebuchadnezzar when Zedekiah's male heirs are slain, Zedekiah blinded, and both Zedekiah and Jehoiakim in prison in Babylon. But the descendants of Zarah and other descendants of Judah were elsewhere, able to link up in later years with the tribes. Now, anybody listening to me for the first time will immediately put a label on me, and you'll make a sad mistake. You stick around a while. I'm no British Israelite. In theology or cultic temperament. But I refuse to let cults who distort things rob God of the faithfulness of His Word and the riches of history since 1800 to uncover what has been lost. These tribes can be found, and the seed of Judah. Now, I'm going to ask you, because I don't want to come back to it, except to quickly pass it. Is there any possible explanation of shepherd kings in Egypt when you time link it to within 40 years after the death of Joseph, they come to power, and 40 years before the birth of Moses, who must be born as a slave, they're kicked out. They didn't have to be in bondage the whole time they were in Egypt. They got in bondage when the shepherd kings were kicked out. What made them get in bondage? Now just think for a moment. Just think with me. Abram had prophesied, God had told him, that they would go down to a land until the fourth generation be there, and would be strangers in that land, but become slaves. Now, they went in as kings. All Egypt mourned when Jacob went back for burial, when his dead body was taken back. They were loved. Joseph was the savior of Egypt. What could make them become so hated? Oh, I know what the Exodus story says in a short, concise statement. What could erase the memory of the debt to Joseph and the respect that would take most of Egypt's leadership to mourn his death in Canaan at the burial? What could so turn them in 200 years to hating them? About the period of the life of this nation, with the death of Joseph, those brethren and their descendants took over and became the shepherd kings. And when a king of South Egypt rose up and ejected them, He put them in slavery, the ones that remained. And thereafter, there was no epitaph as hated as to call him a shepherd in Egypt. Common logic tells you who the shepherd kings were. Get my old history book. I have practically nothing to say. Just one little paragraph. Egypt was conquered by these foreign rulers for a period of about 200 years. Doesn't tell you a thing. Here we go. The history of the old kingdom of Egypt, following the demise of such and such a dynasty, Nile Valley fragmented. Internal disunity was the occasion for foreign invasion. About 1780 B.C., they say here. What did they say there? 1730. I told you, you can always figure 50 year either way is a good safe margin in the dating of these ancient historical timelines going on cuneiform script and other such things. It's a lot. This was written several years ago. It's been cleaned up recently. But in my day, this would have been in the 1950s when I was in university. About 1780, they say an Asiatic people. Our timeline book says Semitic. They now know they were Semitic. The breaking of the code archaeologically, the language, the inscriptions, we know they were Semitic, as were the sons of Jacob. Asiatic, this history book says, whom the Egyptians called Hyksos, possessing a superior army equipped with horses and chariots, swept down on Egypt, thoroughly conquered the region of the Delta, and gradually extended their power over most of Upper Egypt. For two centuries until 1580 B.C., how's that one match? They're 10 years off. 1570, the other one said. But basically, within a 50-year time zone, all it says, for two centuries, these aliens lorded it over the Egyptians, treating them with terrible cruelty and taking much wealth from the Nile Valley. Under such circumstances, the Egyptians, who heretofore had been a peace-loving people, became imbued with a strong nationalistic feeling and hatred of their oppressors and hating all shepherds. Isn't history obtuse? They wouldn't even tell me why Egypt became powerless, dated with the going forth of the Israelites. You read the Bible, the army swallowed up in the Red Sea. Caesar B. DeMille knew that much. Now we find the archaeologists have to figure out the demise of Sennacherib. So they say his army got malaria, killed exactly 185,000 of them. I mean, real discerning malaria mosquitoes. Thus saith the Lord, thou mosquitoes must sting only 185,000. And figure that out. The archaeologists are harder to believe than God. I mean, at least if you can believe in an angel, he can count. Whoever heard of mosquitoes counting? The good old book will stand the test. Common sense tells you who the Hyksos were. Now, the cryptologists say the Greeks didn't know what they were talking about. It's foreign. Now, since my textbook was written, the cryptologists have figured out what the Egyptians called them, foreign rulers. And they say the Greeks made a mistranslation. Well, since the Greek rulers were some of the same kings that had been ejected, forming new kingdoms, I have an idea they may know better than the cryptologists. You guys been standing over there a long time. You know, I was going to quit at 9:30, and I just got caught up. Just got plain caught up. Now I've lost my other book. Where'd it go? Where'd that Gilgamesh epic go? There it is. Where did he find Utnapishtim? Huh? Well, I don't even have to go to that book. Let me go back a little bit. You know when the flood occurred, don't you? 2400 B.C. is a good round figure. But if you miss it by 100 years, don't worry about it. 2500, you're not going to be much off. Now, where did Utnapishtim live, Noah? He went west until he came to the sea. And when he got loose from the barmaid, who increasingly looked like a goddess as he sailed away, he went with the boatman over the sea. Still going west, right? Nobody can figure out. Greek legends describe the magnificent civilization of King Minos of Crete. You ever heard of him? Richest man who ever lived. So when Arthur Evans began to excavate ruins of a hitherto unknown Cretan civilization in 1899, he named it Minoan. I can get a Noah out of that. The people of the island of Crete developed a civilization based on the use of bronze long before any other Europeans. A superior knowledge. Like maybe somebody that had an accumulation of knowledge before the flood. Freed from the threat of war by their ships, which controlled the neighboring seas, they built no fortresses, but concentrated on the comforts of life. Knossos, their capital city, was founded about blank B.C. You know, when Evans began to dig at Knossos, he couldn't figure out this marvelous culture. You guys been standing too long? You can sit down. You want to just go around there and sit on things. I'm about done, though, if you can hold out a minute. They couldn't figure something out. No fortifications. Total peace. They then figured out they had the greatest navy the world ever saw. They didn't have to worry about defending their land. They just shot everybody out of the water with whatever they shot with. Now, who in the new civilization after the flood is the world's greatest boat builder? Huh? You know, non-biblical people are so dense, they couldn't find their way out of a cave with a flashlight sometimes, if it involves a biblical flashlight. Nobody knows. Where did civilization come from? Rich, advanced in metallurgy, protected from marauders on all sides by the greatest ships in the world. Well, when was it? Knossos was founded about 2500 B.C. Give or take a little. The first great civilization after the flood. The Minoan languages survived on about 200 clay tablets, but the script used as Linear A has not yet been fully deciphered. About 300 years after the foundation of Knossos, Greek speakers arrived in the island. They left thousands of tablets written in another script, Linear B. This was deciphered in 1952, found to be an early form of Greek, which said Greek is but a branch of the early language from which both Greek and Hebrew spring. Now, I want to speculate for a minute. Noah was not there when they built the Tower of Babel, you know. Those Greeks had one of those confused languages by the time they got there. Nobody's ever been able to decipher Linear A. It has defied the decipherers. The Rosetta Stone opened up the inscriptions of Egypt. Grotefend broke the cuneiform of Babylon. With Rawlinson and the Behistun inscriptions, they were able to decipher it. They found the three-language inscription. Linear B, a Grecian derivative, a line called Linear B. They've been able to decipher that. Linear A, the inscriptions of Minoan civilization earliest, has defied them. Wouldn't it be interesting if some of those, if Noah built Kenosis, the champion boat builder of the world, just retreated to his island and kept plenty of ships around. And Nimrod had to go across that sea to find him. He's headed right toward Kenosis, right toward Crete. The timeline puts it right after the flood. He's a boat builder. And he's got a language nobody's deciphered. What if that language is the one they were speaking before the Tower of Babel confused it all? Now, when was Kenosis destroyed? Wiped out in a day. Nobody can figure out why it was wiped out in a day. Evans was sitting in his house and an earthquake shook the island. And he decided, that was his theory, though nobody really knows. It was done in a day. When? Kenosis was eventually destroyed by fire, earthquake, around 1400 B.C. What happened in 1400 B.C.? You know, 50 years doesn't make very much difference. 1446 B.C., the Israelites came out of Egypt and the Red Sea was parted and earthquakes just shook everywhere. Isn't that interesting? That's what I call Gestalt field theory. God's handiwork. God moving the checkers. Historians say, who are these shepherd kings? Read the Bible. Jacob's descendants. It was that abuse of power that created the catalyst bringing the rebellion that made Abram's prophecy become fulfilled. They became slaves in bitter bondage. Then comes Moses and the plagues and the parting of the Red Sea. And the successor to the Minoan culture is wiped out in a day. But Noah was living on one of those islands when Nimrod went to try to find him. Why couldn't he be the founder of the Minoan culture? Maybe. I have a little more to say about it. Now, Gilgamesh said, when Gilgamesh sees Utnapishtim and notices, too late. Let's save that. Let's save that one. Give me that same song again. I'm going home in about 15 minutes. I'm not going to say another word to you if you don't talk to me.